Good morning, everyone. We'll begin with the opening chant.
An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Excuse me, Shinshu. This is on gallery. Should it be on gallery? Good morning. I've been thinking for some time that it would be good to talk about, it'd be good to talk about chanting and the practice of chanting, and also about some of the chants that we do here. So that's what I'm going to do today. And some people ask, why do we chant? And as with everything at Ocean Gate, you're welcome to join in whatever activities work for you. You don't have to do any that you don't want to. But if you do, you might ask, why do we chant? Isn't it enough to sit or study or do work practice? And my answer is yes to all of the above. And engaging with something and asking why about it is very good. Sometimes why is a good thing to ask, to weed out what is unwholesome or does not fit. And why can also orient you to the practice. If you ask why and you get some answers, it can give you pointers about how to relate. Chanting is a practice in and of itself, like any other form of meditation. It also connects us as a group and as a community and as a part of the wider Buddhist community, and also to all those that have gone before throughout the generations. Chanting brings the teachings into our lives in a very specific way. In words that have meaning to us when we chant in English. But English or not, chanting envelops us and sings the teachings to us beyond words. It's an atmosphere. It's a way of being exposed. Being willing to move beyond why is also important, because why can be an obstacle to simply being with something, of something, in something, being taught before ideas and opinions. This is what we call entering through form. So you enter and you do something and you allow the practice to teach you, to teach us, by doing it. Doing it this way takes time. It's a gentle, steady practice. We don't stop and examine each thing and say, what have I gained? What has this done for me today? We entrust ourselves to the practice. We allow ourselves to be shaped by it, often without knowing. Zen Master Sung Song is the founder of the Kwannon School. It's a Korean Sun school in North America. Said, so chanting is very important. At first you don't understand, but after you chant regularly, you will understand. Ah, chanting, very good feeling. He goes on to say, it is the same with bowing 108 times in this school, every morning bowing 108 times. He says, at first people don't like this. Why do we bow? We are not bowing to Buddha. We are bowing to ourselves. Small I is bowing to big I. Then small I disappears and becomes big I. This is true bowing. So come practice with us. You will soon understand. To chant, we have the same spirit. We bring our whole bodies and minds into it. We are not watching our bodies and minds. We are expressing through our bodies and minds who we are. We are engaged fully in this bodily practice. Usually we chant together, and as Master Sung Song says, this is excellent. But right now, during the pandemic, often we do it alone. Unless you have another person in your household or your bubble or that you can do it with, mostly you do it alone. Doing it together melts our separation. We are one sound, one voice, one body. We don't try and aim for a certain pitch or harmony. We are ourselves. And as we say, we chant with our ears. We do not dominate, nor do we disappear. We do not attempt to haul the group into a tone or a pace that we think is right, nor do we become passive in our engagement. We join fully in the process. If there's a drum, like there often is, we make the drum our heartbeat and allow it to guide us. This is a particular kind of practice. It is, in a sense, lived interdependence. Bodies in a room, sound enveloping us, everybody's voice unique, all blending together in a way that is magical in a way. When we are ourselves, when we come forward with our own voice together with others, there is something that happens, and it doesn't have to be predicted ahead of time. So that is the usual way. But doing it alone can also be a very good thing. So I have a few reasons I'd like to share with you this morning. First, doing it alone can make it personal. You can hear your own voice, feel your own intention. No one else is chanting with you. If you're lucky enough to be alone where no one else can hear you, you can experiment with breath and tone, full-bodied expression. You can really belt it out if you don't have neighbors right on the other side of the wall or someone that might be disturbed. You can see what that feels like. In any case, you can find that range, that pace that suits you at that time. You don't have to attend to anyone else. This can be a very important way to deepen your relationship with the process of chanting. And also, if it's in English, to the text that you're chanting. You have a chance as an individual to experience how this is grounding and also how it expands your being. Like Master Sung Song said, it feels good. There's no need to understand the contents. They enter us. They touch us. If we do understand the intention or the meaning of the words, that's good too. It is included in the complexity of this whole practice. Meaning, phrase, image, intuitive sense all enter our minds and hearts and all are also available to us at other times. This is a rich and beneficial resource. It's a power present in our lives. So we just do the practice fully. Allow the various aspects of it to be present and to transform our human experience. We can also, this is a slightly different practice, find phrases or sections of a sutra and memorize and chant them. In this way, we weave a structure of support for ourselves in the Dharma. Reciting sutras is also understood in Buddhism to generate what we call merit. There's a lot that we could say about merit. It's a complicated term, and we won't do that right now. But just think of it as a kind of beneficial energy. This beneficial energy is never kept for ourselves. It is always dedicated, turned over to all beings, to a particular person, to the earth, to any being. It's not that it excludes us. It can include us. But it's a non-selfish way of practicing generosity. This is essential. This is our way of awakening. We are included, but we're not the center. So following a chant, either in a formal setting at the Zendo or a Buddha hall, where the chant leader recites what's called an echo, E-K-O, a dedication of merit. That's what happens in a formal setting. But if you're chanting alone, you know, you can make one up. Yes, there are formal ones that you can memorize, but you can make one up or simply silently think of someone, a being of any kind, or the earth, or supporting a movement towards justice or mercy or awakening. Or you can chant something aloud. You can be quiet. You can be silent. You can chant it aloud. You can make it up. The point is that when you finish chanting, whatever beneficial energy has been aroused, has been generated, you spread that. Give it. Practice generosity. When you chant, you want to be aware of a few things. First, you can do it quietly or loudly, alone or with others, anytime, any place. If possible, if your body is able to do that, you should be free and upright. Standing or sitting is fine. Standing often allows us to be engaged in a certain way, but sitting is also fine. Breathe deeply and quietly to start. Settle your mind and bring your focus to the chant. Put your heart into it. Allow it to touch you. If you want to develop your chanting voice, you can do that too. It's not necessary. Whatever voice you have is the voice you have. But if you'd like to do that, and it's possible, again, always pay attention to your body, what's possible with your body. If you can, stand erect and loose, plant your feet, and relax. Find the base of your breath. Don't hyperventilate. Don't breathe too deep. Just simple, deep breaths into your belly. Take a few of these. Use your diaphragm. Pay attention to any tendency to breathe from up here. If you're anxious, like we have a very long and complicated, fairly complicated chant that we do at the full moon ceremony, and the chant leader does it in front of the community. And always, the first time you're the chant leader, your voice tends to come out more as a squeak than a chant. You know, there you are on your own practicing this, and it's like there's this full chant that comes out. And then you stand up in the community, and it's like, ah. That's usually what happens. And there's so much kindness. There's so much humility involved in this. So if you practice, Get used to what your breath is, what your voice is. Relax. Breathe deep. Let your vocal cords and your neck be open. Chant from your belly through your heart out. Bring your whole self into it. Gently and easily and fully. You're not shouting. Your voice can be quiet and very strong. You're not trying to force anything. Be easy. This is a practice, not a performance. If you want to do some other kinds of practice, you can go to the woods or the ocean, somewhere where you can cut loose and see what happens. One way of doing this is stand a few feet away from a person, a rock, a tree, and chant to it. Then stand further back, and then further back. Don't strain. Just allow it to be what it is. Find your voice. Be intimate with your voice. This is an expression of who you are in the Buddha way. So I encourage you to try it. Some of our chants are in Japanese, and Japanese is a much easier language to chant in than English. English is kind of clunky. In Japanese, if we don't know the meaning of the words, then engaging with body and breath and mind is the only thing. So chanting in Japanese is a good way to go. Some of the Japanese chants really can't be translated. For example, a chant like the Daihi Shinrani, they're usually not translated. We can think of them as having no specific meaning other than the sounds, except their auspicious power and their intention. Some are considered to have esoteric or symbolic meaning. When we chant, for example, the Daihi Shinrani, we're invoking the presence and power of compassion. We are now doing 49 days of chanting, as I mentioned the last time I talked, for our teacher, Hakuri Yosojin Roshi, who died recently. According to the Soto School scriptures for daily practices and practice, translating Dharanis like the Daihi Shinrani into English, you know, it's a complicated process because started in an original language, went to Chinese, and went to Japanese, and now we're doing our best. This is all transliteration of the sound, of the sound. So if we try and translate it, we go to the sound, and then we try and work backwards to the original language, and we don't even know for sure what it is, the Indic language. And then we go back to that, and then we try and translate that into English. So it's a very iffy proposition, reconstruction of this. Really, it's best to just engage with these directly as sound and not worry about the meaning, just the sense of it. English chants take a bit more doing. The nice thing for English speakers is that the meaning seeps into your heart and mind. The words, the phrases, the connections become a part of you. But understanding the meaning can hijack you into thinking. So then you're thinking about the chanting instead of chanting. You're thinking about the meaning. In some way, this is inevitable. So, like in Zazen, you just let it go. Come back to your body and breath and intention. Some chants we do in Japanese can be translated. Though this is, even in this way, when we know the meaning of something, it's tricky. So, what I thought I'd do now is talk a little bit about one of the Japanese chants that we do regularly that you can understand in English. And this chant is called the Enmeijuku Kenangyo, or the 10 Phrase Kenon Sutra. I kind of did some exploring and found some very interesting things about this, written about this. One done by Eigyoko Nakao, Roshi of the Los Angeles Zen Center, and others by the Soto Zen North America materials. So this chant invokes the presence of the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Kenon, Kanji Sai, they who hear the cries of the world. This is the Japanese name for Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion in Sanskrit. This chant is often recited in support of healing, sustaining life, and for those in distress. It is a call for us to practice directly with the mind of Kenon. This combination of devotional and introspective practice was typical in the Ming Dynasty. This is just for those of you that are geeky about this kind of thing, which the Ming Dynasty from like mid-1600s to early 1900s in China. And this time had a great influence on Japanese Zen. So it's important when you think about a chant like this or you approach a chant like this, it both has a devotional invoking the presence of Kenon, but remembering that this is your own person is Kenon. So our teachings and literature include a lot about Kenon Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara, the Lotus Sutra, which is a central text of our tradition, and many traditions, is filled with references to Kenon. In fact, in our regular morning service, we chant a short English version of one of the chapters of the Lotus Sutra about Kenon. And the great Japanese Rinzai Zen master Hakuin, who lived in the late 1600s into the mid-1700s, wrote a book about this chant and recommended chanting it 200 or 300 times a day. 200 or 300. So I think this is kind of shorthand for just chant it over and over and over again all day long. He spoke of its healing power, and that those in distress would find consolation in it, as well as a transformative power. This chant is a way of bringing close the spirit of compassion, solace, consolation, and extending it to those in need, which can include us. It also calls us to become Kenon, to know ourselves as Kenon. It is sometimes called the life-extending Kenon Sutra. And I think that we can think of life-extending in many ways. Not just like we're going to live longer, but outward, life-extending, life-saturating. In Japanese, I'm just going to read this, not chant it. And this is another thing you can do, you know? If you have a text that you like and you're used to chanting it, recite it to yourself in normal speaking voice. It can, especially if you're in distress or you want to invoke that, it can open doors. So, here's the Enmeijuku Kenangyo. Kanzeyan namu butsu yo butsu uin yo butsu uen. Buso ho en jo raku ga jo chonen kanzeyan bonen kanzeyan nen nen jushin ki nen nen furishin. So there are a lot of translations in English. I could find at least 8 to 10. And each are a little different. Each have a little different point of view. So it's really good to look at all of them. The title, Enmeijuku Kenangyo. Enmei is boundless. Endless, vast. Juku is 10 phrases. And Kenon, as we've said, is the bodhisattva of compassion. Gyo means sutra. So sutra are the words of the Buddha. There are, just as an aside, there are many texts that are called sutras that were clearly written long after the historical Buddha's life. And why they're called sutras is very interesting, but again, not for today. So, boundless, endless, vast, 10 phrases, Bodhisattva Compassion Sutra. The first line is an invocation of Kanzeon. It's often translated with an exclamation point. Kanzeon. So there's strength in it. There's a sense of urgency in it, in a way. We're calling forth the spirit of compassion that lives in us and in the entire world. That's an expression of the interconnection of all being. That's this alive generosity, compassion, connection. Kan means to perceive or contemplate. Ze means world. On means sound. So this particular name for Kenon, for the Bodhisattva of Compassion, is one who hears the sounds or often the cries of the world. So this invites us to consider, who is that one? Who is the one that can open to the suffering of the world, that can hear the suffering of the world, that can be touched by it? The one that can do that and still stay stable, fully attentive, free of anxiety, not sunk by what they hear, see, feel, touch, buoyant and responsive, alive. Who is that one? Kanzeon. This is a question we can live with as we chant this name. There's a vigor in it. The next line is Namu Butsu. Namu means to pay homage and also to name. There's also a sense of refuge and reliance in being one with. Butsu is Buddha. So we can understand Namu Butsu as naming Buddha, honoring Buddha, as our source, as our refuge. There's also no separation. Namu Butsu. Many translations focus on the sense that we and Buddha are one. And we pay homage to that. That's a good thing. But I also think if we just focus on that, we can truncate what sometimes is required for us to actually come to know that. We are calling in this chant for the compassions of the Buddhas to be present, for those who are in distress, lost, and for ourselves when we do not remember that we are one with the Buddha. That calling in itself is a return to oneness. So emphasizing one with Buddha, I don't think is enough. We need to understand calling. We need to understand naming. We need to know Namu. So some translations of this line are, I venerate Buddha, and paying homage to the Buddha, takes refuge in the Buddha, salutation and devotion to Buddha, one with Buddha. One with Buddha is the most common. But as I said, I think it's important to not just stick with that one. Yo butsu in, the next line, yo means with, in means direct or immediate cause, like a seed, right? The seed of a lemon tree does not become a redwood tree. There's an immediate cause. So this is a sense of directly Buddha, a direct link with Buddha, this oneness of Buddha, immediate, no place to go. Yo butsu in. Translations include forged a causal connection with Buddha, directly Buddha, Buddha is my source. You can hear the differences. You know, they're getting at the same thing, but you can hear to forge a causal connection with Buddha sounds very different than directly Buddha or Buddha is my source. And yet they point us to this feeling, this understanding. Yo butsu en is the next line. En, very interesting word, en. It has a sense of indirect connection or indirect cause. So the conditions that support the arising of something, enabling conditions. I like that, enabling conditions. So something that is needed for something to come into fruition. So, for example, good soil, proper weather, support the growth of a seed. Also, in and en together is often translated as karmic affinity. Now, that's a whopper of a term, isn't it? But these are conditions that are linked through many, 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 many causes. A kind of sympathetic accord or kinship, intertwinedness. That's the sense of karmic affinity, inen. So these two lines kind of play with inen. Inen. Some translations are a karmic affinity with Buddha, indirectly Buddha. Buddha is my affinity and related to all Buddhas in cause and effect. So again, you hear these, this variation, but all of them trying to express this sense of affinity connection. The next line, Bu Po So En. Bu is Buddha, Po is Dharma, and So is Sangha. So again, we have En, connection, affinity, deep interdependence of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, not separate. The next line, Jo, Raku Ga Jo, are the four attributes of Nirvana, which is free from impermanence, free from impermanence, suffering, lack of self, and impurity. In this round of birth and death, we are marked by these four attributes. And in Nirvana, in realization, we are free. Jo is usually translated as permanent, endless, or eternal. This is tricky, because we all know nothing has unchanging self. Nothing doesn't change. So what is it that we say is permanent? That's why I think it's better to talk about being freed from impermanence, some condition in which we are unbound by what usually binds us. So we need not to be bound by assumptions about what permanent, endless, or eternal means. Raku is often translated as happiness or joy. Those fit. But I like ease. Happiness and joy, ease kind of completes happiness and joy. Happiness and joy can sound kind of, you know. Ease has a sense of stability and serenity to it. Ga is self. Jo is purity. So this is a purity that's not apart from the world. It's a pure intention, pure responsiveness, complete connection. So again, these words are tricky, so it's important to remember that we're not talking about a permanent self that is endlessly happy. They point to a way of being that is free from bondage, free from what constricts us, the suffering that we so often experience. It's responsive, buoyant, alive, expressive of Buddha's wisdom and compassion. So some translations are joyful, pure, eternal being. You could see where that could get really mixed up. Being eternal, intimate, pure, and joyful. And another is constancy, ease, assurance, and purity. All of these are pointing to a way that is not bound by the constrictions that we usually. This is the spirit of compassion we're talking about here. The spirit of Kenon. The next line, Cho Nin Kanzeon. Cho is morning. It's morning time. Nen, mindful recitation. Mindfulness recitation. What we do with our minds. This is more than thinking. It's about turning toward. Orientation. Mindful recitation. This line means that in the morning we recall ourselves to Kanzeon. We put our attention on Kanzeon. We return to the qualities that are life-sustaining for us and for all beings. So some translations of this are, in the morning, be one with Kanzeon. Another is, morning mind is Kanzeon. Or, morning my thought is Kanzeon. Or, in the morning I think of Kanzeon. So morning mind is Kanzeon, and in the morning, in the beginning, when I wake up, I turn my mind to Kanzeon. The next line is Bonen Kanzeon. Bo is evening. So this line reminds us to end our days with Kanzeon. Or you could think of Hakuin Senji, who says, recite this 300 times a day and you'll not stray away from it at all. You'll end up your days with Kanzeon. We can think of this whole chant as a practice instruction. In the morning, we call Kanzeon. In the evening, we recall Kanzeon. We end our days with Kanzeon, both each day and when we end our days. Translations are, in the evening, be one with Kanzeon. When we think about dying, be one with Kanzeon. Evening mind is Kanzeon. Evening my thought is Kanzeon. In the evening, I think of Kanzeon. So we start our day and we end our day. And if we're following Hakuin Zenji's way, we go about our day. Kanzeon, Kanzeon. The final two lines shift from, one way of looking at them is a shift from Kanzeon as an object of devotion and focus attention on the teachings that mind in its essence is nothing other than Buddha, Bushin. And we can rest in that. So this next line is a Nen Nen Jushin Ki. Nen again. Nen is mindful recitation, turning our attention to not just thought, but our awareness, our conscious being. Ju means to follow, and Shin is heart mind. Usually translated as mind, but we have to remember that in Japanese, it is not between our ears mind, it is consciousness mind, it is heart and mind. So the sense of this is that who we are is this mindful recitation. Egyeka Roshi describes this as each thought following the preceding thought is big mind. Moment after moment, small mind is an expression of big mind. Now we know, we've been saying, there's no difference here, and yet there's something about phrasing it this way to ourselves, that we are an expression of Buddha, an expression of big mind. Nen nen. Nen nen jushin. So when we practice in this way, Nen nen jushin ki, we are returning moment after moment to what we already are. our mind and heart follows in a way, is in tune with the mind of the Bodhisattva, the mind of Buddha. And when we practice in this way, we know this from the inside out, so to speak. So some translations of this are, Nin-nin arises from mind. Thought after thought arises from mind. And this very moment arises from mind. The last line is, Nin-nin furishin. Again, nin. This is key to the whole thing. Nin. Attend. Orient. Listen. Remember. Mindfully recite. It reminded me of, the rule of St. Benedict. When I went back to Tassara to be Shuso, I studied the rule of St. Benedict while I was there. It's a part of my graduate studies. And I was really struck by the fact that the first word is ascolte, attend, listen, ascolte, listen. This is nen, this is namu. This is attend with your whole being. So, nin-nin fu-ri-shin. Fu is not, means not. Ri-ri is separate. Shin is mind-heart. So, some translations are thought after thought is not separate from mind. This very moment is not separate from mind. Nin-nin is not separate from mind. Nin-nin. Attend. Live this out. Kenon is not separate from mind. We are not separate. That is always true. And when we attend, we come to know that. All of the meanings, all of this can inform us. And it is good to know translations people have come up with for chants like the Enmeijuku Kanonkyo or others. But again, don't let the words snag or entrap you. If you take on a practice like chanting the Enmeijuku Kanonkyo, take a walk with it. Chant it silently or quietly or loudly. And pay attention to what the world has to say to you about this. What happens? Nen. What happens? Chanting as a whole is a practice that is done simply and at ease. No striving. Just expressing. So I encourage you to find a chant such as this that speaks to you. It is a way to practice nin, to recall ourselves to what we are. Try it. If you want to join us in the morning for Zazen in service, you are most welcome. But also do it on your own. In fact, if you join us for service, you're going to be chanting on your own because you'll be on Zoom. And as we all know, everybody getting together and trying to chant or sing together on Zoom is a train wreck. So, even if you join us, you'll be chanting by yourself or with another person in your household. And when we can join together again, we'll come together and chant these chants together and feel the dynamic activity of one voice, one mind, one body. But I encourage you to try this. Nin-nin in the morning, in the evening, throughout your day. Give your body, heart, and mind over to chanting and see what happens. Thank you.